WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On a spring day in 1921, the African-American section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was burned down by a white mob. The riot was set off after a black man was accused of attacking a white woman and was threatened with the possibility of lynching. In this neighborhood of about 8,000 people, more than 1,000 homes were burned to the ground, thousands of people were left homeless, and an estimated 100 to 300 people were killed. The Oklahoma legislature recently appointed a commission to investigate what happened during the riot and whether any reparations should be given. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a survivor of the riot whose house was burned down. First, we'll hear from Alfred Brophy. He wrote the Tulsa Race Riot Commission's report, which recommends reparations for survivors and could set an important precedent for other states. The report was presented to the legislature earlier this month. Brophy is a professor of law at Oklahoma City University. I asked him to describe the scope of the destruction after the riot.
The destruction was extraordinary. More than 30 blocks of Greenwood, the black section of Tulsa, were burned to the ground. Some of the photographs that you see of the riot scene are reminiscent of Carthage or Hiroshima after World War II. Very little left standing. You'll see occasionally scenes of concrete or piles of brick, telephone poles, metal bedstands, and very little else.
What set off the riot?
The riot was set off on the evening of May 31st, 1921, when a group of black World War I veterans showed up at the Tulsa County Courthouse to try and stop what they thought was going to be the lynching of 19-year-old Dick Rowland. He was a young black man who worked shining shoes in an office building downtown Tulsa, and he'd gone up to the top of a nearby building to use the segregated bathroom facilities there. As he was exiting the elevator, the story, so far as we can now reconstruct it, is that he tripped and fell into 17-year-old Mary Page, who was a white woman who worked as the elevator operator. And at the time she screamed, he ran out of the elevator, and nobody thought anything else of it. The Tulsa Tribune, one of the two leading white newspapers in town, picked this story up in its afternoon edition on May 31st and ran two stories, so far as we can tell. One of them talking about the attempted assault on Mary Page, and the other one, an editorial which has since been lost, which we think was encouraging folks to go and lynch Dick Rowland. The editorial's been lost, actually, so we don't know exactly what it said. Folks then down in Greenwood, the black section of town, started to get worried that Dick Rowland was going to be lynched. And there's some interesting stories about sort of what's going on in black and white Tulsa. The newspaper hits the streets about 4 p.m., and people down in Greenwood get very agitated, or very concerned that Rowland is going to be lynched. By about 7 o'clock in the evening, a contingent of maybe 25 to 30 black World War I veterans who've gone home, put on their uniforms to show their bona fides, come down to the courthouse and offer their assistance to help protect Dick Rowland, who at this point has been arrested and is in the jail at the top of the Tulsa County Courthouse. At this point, by 7 p.m., there's maybe 400 or so whites, mostly men, but there's some women and children also, at the courthouse. The sheriff assures the men there's going to be no lynching, encourages them to go back across the tracks into Greenwood, and tries to disperse the white crowd as well. There's some success with that, but by about 9:30, the white crowd at the courthouse has gotten larger. People back in Greenwood are still very agitated. They make another trip down to the courthouse. And at this point, estimates are varying. There's maybe 50 to 75 black veterans. And again, the sheriff encourages them, go home. there isn't going to be a lynching.
So the authorities seem to be trying to quiet things down and disperse the black and white crowds that have gathered. So how did things reach the point of riot?
I think there was a failure of the Tulsa Police Department at this point. There's lots of talk right after the riot that 20 armed men could have easily dispersed the crowd, but they failed to do that. And in fact, that's one of the charges that Police Chief Gustafson is brought up on after the riot for having failed to disperse both the blacks and whites. Now, after this second confrontation, apparently some police officers are trying to disarm the black veterans who have shown up. One person we think is a police officer, it's a little bit unclear, is taking guns away, says to one of the leaders, "Where are you going with that gun?" And he says, "I'll use it if I have to." There's a struggle, the gun goes off, and then in the parlance of the time, all hell breaks loose.
One of the things that seems to have either turned this into a riot or made the riot even worse than it otherwise would have been is that a lot of the men who were initially part of the white mob ended up getting deputized as assistant police. Why were they deputized, and what did they do after being deputized?
You've put your finger on what strikes me as one of the key aspects of this riot. Right after the initial confrontation at the courthouse, when, in the words of the police chief and many other people at the time, all hell breaks loose, the response of the police department is to deputize dozens, perhaps hundreds, of men. There are allegations at the time that they're told to go home, get a gun, and get a black person, except they use much more offensive language than that, of course. Why exactly the police department did this is an important question. There's substantial evidence that they thought this was, to use the language of the time, a Negro uprising. Think about this, the way in which the black World War I veterans clashed with the ideas of the position they should occupy in Tulsa society. Those veterans, men who had traveled the world, came back with wonderful ideas about equality. And at the time, people in Greenwood are talking about the NAACP's anti-lynching campaign, the bill in Congress to prevent lynching. They're talking about the importance of arming themselves and protecting themselves against white attack. In September 1920, there was a lynching on the same weekend in both Tulsa and Oklahoma City. In Tulsa, it was a white man who was lynched. In Oklahoma City, it was a black man. And the Tulsa Star, the leading black newspaper at the time in Tulsa, editorialized, excoriated blacks in Oklahoma City for not having saved that man. They editorialized that it was their legal right, indeed their duty, to arm themselves, march to the jail, apprise the sheriff that they were there to protect life and that they should take life if need be to uphold the law and protect the prisoner. So at the time of the riot, the police think this is an uprising and want to do everything they can to put down the uprising. It's a climate of extraordinary fear that leads to this mass deputization.
Once the white men were deputized as assistant police, what did they do during the actual riot?
There's a lot of testimony that the people largely responsible for arresting blacks and then as soon as homes and businesses were vacant, burning them.
So it's people suddenly in this official capacity who are doing a lot of the damage. The National Guard was called in. How did the National Guard handle itself?
The National Guard is actually a very interesting story. Unlike the special deputies who I think were largely responsible for the destruction, the National Guard, we need to break into two groups, the local units of the Guard and the units from Oklahoma City. The local units of the Guard were called into operation about 9:30 or 10 o'clock on the evening of May 31st. Their instructions from the governor are to not shoot unless fired upon and try and protect lives. Also, to arrest blacks and take them to the convention center. And by about 3 a.m. on the morning of June 1st, they're actively engaged in disarming and arresting blacks, turning them over to the civilian authorities where they're taken to the convention center and detained. There is no evidence that either the local or the national or the out-of-town units of the Guard were involved in the burning. I think there's some culpability on the part of the local units of the Guard for simply arresting blacks and then leaving their property unprotected where it could be burned by the special deputies and the mob.
What was the motivation for arresting and detaining African Americans?
That's very interesting. There's some evidence that there was concern this was an uprising, and they wanted to disarm and end the violence in that way. There's also some evidence that particularly the units of the National Guard from Oklahoma City were primarily concerned with trying to protect lives and in that way simply arrest and put into protective custody the Greenwood residents. Now, that strikes me as a very favorable interpretation for the Guard. There is a lot of evidence afterwards that the out-of-town units of the Guard were very important in protecting lives and that they treated Greenwood residents with respect. You can there are photographs of the riot you can contrast. One is titled Captured Negroes on the Way to Convention Center, and they're walking with their hands up. That's a photograph of the special deputies taking Greenwood residents to the convention center. When you contrast that with National Guard troops, folks are not being marched with their hands up. It is a very different, I think, way of treating the people who are in custody.
My guest is Professor Alfred Brophy, author of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission Report. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Alfred Brophy is my guest. He's a professor of law at Oklahoma City University. He wrote the report, Reconstructing the Dreamland, Contemplating Civil Rights Actions and Reparations for the Tulsa Race Riot of 1929. And the commission that he's part of is recommending reparations be paid to survivors of this 1921 race riot, and the report has been forwarded to the state legislature. After the riot was over, and after the African Americans who were kept at this detention center were released, were there any efforts at all made by the city or the state to help African Americans rebuild their homes, rebuild the neighborhood, rebuild the stores in the neighborhood?
There were some efforts, actually. The Private Reconstruction Committee in Tulsa collected, I think, about $100,000. There are wonderful stories about some of the local employers spending money to reconstruct houses for their employees who lived in Greenwood. I think that's one of the really important stories about the riot that people haven't focused on is the way in which, you know, churches as well as the Red Cross expended money and effort to try and reconstruct Greenwood.
But it obviously wasn't enough money to do a very effective job at reconstructing that neighborhood.
Property losses were estimated at $1.5 million, and as I say, I think it was about $100,000 that was expended of private money. It certainly was not the effort that one would have hoped Tulsa as an entire city would put forward. In fact, one of the interesting stories about the riot is just after the riot, the city council passes a zoning ordinance extending the fire limits to encompass Greenwood and prohibiting rebuilding of Greenwood with anything other than fireproof material. And that was made rebuilding prohibitively expensive. That was eventually struck down as an interference with property rights.
Was that seen as an intentional way of preventing African Americans from rebuilding?
It's very interesting, yes. At the time it was the zoning ordinance was passed, there was an article in the newspaper discussing the reasons for it. One was that they wanted to expand this would allow the expansion of the industrial district and the railroad yard that was there. And the second was to get more separation between the races. So essentially, the zoning ordinance was designed to prohibit rebuilding by blacks in Greenwood.
And these were the days when you could say that the intention is to separate the races, and that could be perceived as legit, a legit motive.
Absolutely. In fact, Tulsa still had a racially restrictive zoning ordinance, which the Supreme Court of the United States had struck down in 1917.
Well, let's look at the issue of reparations. That's why your commission was convened in the first place. And the commission has, in fact, recommended that reparations be given to the survivors of the 1921 Tulsa race riot, the survivors who had their homes destroyed or their businesses destroyed. Let's look at some of the key factors in deciding on reparations. You say that, you know, one of the issues is that city officials failed to protect the lives of African-American residents. What are the specifics with that?
I think perhaps the strongest argument in favor of reparations is that the city had an affirmative hand in arresting blacks and burning Greenwood.
Through the deputizing of the white men.
Through the deputies, sure. And this is something that in the trial of the police chief afterwards for neglect of duty during the riot, the police commissioner acknowledges that we deputized people we shouldn't have deputized. There were people who may have lost their head after they got the badge. And this is the police chief who acknowledges this. And even the Oklahoma Supreme Court, not known for its enlightened attitudes towards race in the 1920s, acknowledges in an insurance case that many of the people doing the burning were wearing deputy police badges.
So the city not only didn't do enough to protect black residents, it took actions that helped destroy property and kill residents.
Absolutely. And I think that's what distinguishes and makes so the case for reparations in Greenwood so strong. This is not a case like Rosewood, where there was a terrible riot over the course of about a week in 1923 in Florida. The Florida legislature gave set aside about $2 million to help victims and their descendants of the Rosewood massacre. But in Rosewood, the state officials knew about the riot and didn't do anything to protect Rosewood residents. In Greenwood, I think the case is substantially stronger. Many of the people doing the burning were, at least temporarily, police officials. And then there's also on the part of at least the local units of the National Guard, they were arresting people, leaving their property defenseless, and that allowed then the mobs and the special deputies to come along and burn. Now, even if one were to say, well, these special deputies were acting sort of outside of the scope of their authority, there is still precedent for reparations when a local government fails to protect. Illinois, for instance, had a statute that provided for compensation when local officials didn't protect against a mob. So people whose property had been destroyed by mob in East St. Louis and in Chicago in 1919 were able to recover.
What about the National Guard? Does the behavior of the National Guard that was called in during the riot enter into your recommendation that reparations be given?
I think the National Guard is going to be central. It strikes me as though there's lots of reason for giving reparations if all we have is the sort of misbehavior of local Tulsa officials. But in Oklahoma, there seems to be a sentiment growing that unless people can show that indeed the state, rather than the city of Tulsa, had some culpability, that the state legislature will not pay reparations.
And what do you think the culpability of the National Guard is?
I think the units of the National Guard that arrived from Oklahoma City at about 9 o'clock on June 1st did a great deal to actually save lives. There's lots of testimony from both blacks and whites that the Oklahoma City units of the National Guard ended the riot, that they, in fact, shot a number of white rioters. In fact, I have heard it said that one of the great secrets of the riot is the number of whites that were killed by the National Guard in putting down the riot. I think we're going to be focusing largely on the local units of the National Guard. Those local units came into operation at about 9:30 or 10 o'clock on the evening of May 31st, and from about 3 o'clock in the morning on June 1st on, they were systematically arresting blacks and turning them over, disarming them, arresting them, and turning them over to civilian authorities where they were detained at the convention center. Those arrests seem to have been based exclusively on race. There is testimony in one of the after-action reports of a local unit of the Guard that when they were fired upon, they'd arrested some blacks. They were taking them down to the convention center, and at that point, white rioters opened fire. And instead of going and trying to arrest the white rioters, the local unit of the Guard marches their prisoners at a faster pace. So I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests the local units of the Guard were working in close contact with the special deputies, the civilian authorities, who we know were doing much of the burning.
Alfred Brophy wrote the Tulsa Race Riot Commission report recommending reparations. He'll be back in the second half of the show, along with a survivor of the riot. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.